Welcome to Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of
woodworking.
I'm Guy from Guy's Shop, and as always, I'm joined by my friends Hui Hun, also known as the Alabama Woodworker.
Good morning.
Good morning. And also Brian Schmidt.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Brian. And this podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops. And we also have a Patreon account, and right now we have one level, and we're simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the cost of bringing you this podcast. So please go to patreon.com/woodshoplife and stay tuned to the end of the show to hear about what we've got going on in our own shops. So let's get right into it. Hui, you've got the first question.
Okay, so the first question is from Scott Goldwaith. I'm planning on making a face grain chessboard. I'll use 3/4 inch MDF as my core and glue the chess squares on top, grain from all squares facing in the same direction. Chess squares will be about 1/8 inch thick. I assume I'll also need to glue some 1/8 inch wood on the bottom to balance out the stresses. I'll orient the bottom grain in the same direction as the top. My question is, do I need to glue both sides at the same time, or can I glue one side, let it dry, then do the other? Okay, so I have never done the technique that you've done, Scott. I would probably not do that. And here's the reason why. Is because it's not wood movement that you're trying to balance out by using a balance veneer. What you're trying to prevent is from the stresses and the pressure from the glue shrinkage from creating a bow or a curve in that MDF. Now, who's to say, I don't know, maybe if you did that, if it did bow or curl a little bit once you took it out of the bag, and you veneered the other side, that it would even out. I don't know. I haven't experimented on that. All I know is that if you are using shop-sawn veneer, which is 1/8 inch thick, well, honestly, for any veneer for that matter, even if it's commercial veneer, the point is what you're trying to balance out by using that balance board is to balance out the stresses from the glue drying, not necessarily the wood movement. And my bottom line is, I don't know if that did happen. If you had a bow, could it balance out if you put another board, sheet of veneer on the other side? And does it necessarily happen every single time? I don't know. Probably not. Maybe so. But why would you take the risk when you're making a beautiful chessboard? I would just do it both at the same time and try to. And I know the issue that you have, Scott, is about alignment. Use blue painter's tape. It actually does not move as much as you think it does. Guy, I know you've done a lot of veneering. I've learned most of my veneering techniques from your videos. So, you know, what are your thoughts on this?
I think you need to find a better teacher for veneer. I've done a lot of chessboards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think 1/8 inch thick is... If you're going to go 1/8 inch thick, I think the glue is also important. Mm-hmm. Mainly because if that, it's still going to, the veneer is still going to expand and contract at 1/8 inch thick. And I can't remember, I think the regulation size for a chessboard is 16 inches. Mm-hmm. Because you've got 8 squares going either way, and the squares are supposed to be 2 inches square. So if you take a board that's 1/8 inch thick and 16 inches wide, it's going to expand and contract over that width more than you would think, mainly because of the thickness of the board. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do that, I would use epoxy or urea resin glue underneath it to make sure it, the wood doesn't move around too much. You're almost going to lock it in. But in regards to the gluing on the bottom, you're absolutely right. It's not a matter of the veneer. It's a matter of the glue balancing out, because when the glue dries, it will shrink the boards one way. But like I said, something like epoxy or urea resin, that's a lot less.
Right.
Than if you use like a PVA based cold veneer glue.
So I have a question for you on that. If you don't have a vacuum bag, so if you're going to do that veneering by using, say, you know, some sort of clamping collar board that you're going to sandwich on top of it to clamp down, can you use the urea resin glue or the epoxy with that?
Sure. Sure.
It won't. So usually I use like a pre-finished plywood, like a UV one side plywood, and that'll be the side that is clamped down to the veneer when I'm veneering.
Yeah, like a clamping call.
Yeah. So you're saying that the epoxy or the urea resin glue, it won't stick or grab or hold on that UV one side plywood. I know it doesn't.
I don't know. I don't use UV one for something like that. It's not designed for it.
Yeah.
So I use melamine.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair.
Does not stick to melamine.
Okay. So it doesn't stick to melamine.
No.
I've used, is it Hardy board? Is that what it's called? It's essentially MDF that's coated, right? And then I'll wax that just to give it a little bit of extra barrier between the MDF or the Hardy board and the glue itself.
That's a good point. Put some wax on there.
Yeah. What kind of wax would you use?
Just wax. Furniture wax. Yeah. Yeah.
Paste wax.
Paste wax.
Johnson's paste wax. Yeah.
So that paste wax ends up touching your finished surface, your veneered surface in that case, right? And you just wipe it off, sand it off.
A little bit of sanding.
A little bit of sanding, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Mm-hmm. You're going to sand it anyway, so.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll get a little glue seepage or whatever, you know, and you just sand it off if there's a big pore in the wood or whatnot. So you're going to have to sand it anyway.
Yeah.
I should mention the advantage to urea resin glue or epoxy is that it doesn't creep.
Right.
It dries rigid and it never creeps, unlike PVA glue. Which is a cold press veneer, which is just regular PVA glue with some stuff mixed in it. And that's important. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, cool.
All right. I guess we're moving on to Brian for his next question.
All right.
My first question
is from Adam. And Adam writes, I'm a new listener and podcast has been a blast to listen to on my evening runs. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I just finished a 3-year long gut to the studs home renovation and my 1-car garage was a renovation workshop. Now that the home is finished, I am transitioning the shop into a proper woodworking space. During construction, I used a lot of 16D nails and 3-inch construction screws and tried to have a variety of fasteners on hand so I wouldn't be running to the hardware store 3 times a day. This got me thinking, what are some common fasteners you like to keep in your shop? Any common size screws, bolts, washers, nuts, nails, staples? It seems in woodworking shops that there's always a balance between having so many supplies that you'll never use most of them in 10 years to having so few supplies that you'll be running to the store 5 times a day. What is your approach to hardware consumables? Thanks for the great podcast. Adam, good question. I love shop organization questions because that's one of the things I love about woodworking is trying to have a organized shop that promotes safety and efficiency with the little bit of time I get down here. So for my shop, I am a less is more type of hardware person. So I keep 1¼-inch like pan head screws, like cabinet screws.
Yeah.
And I like those because I can, if I need to, you know, put 2 pieces of 3/4-inch plywood together, they're about as deep as you can go without going through the other side. So 1¼-inch pan head. I like 1½-inch more of a, like a traditional like framing screw. I really like GRK fasteners. Mm-hmm. And then I'll also have a 2½-inch GRK screw as well, which they say they're good for exterior use, interior use. So they're pretty versatile. I have, knock on wood, never in my life broken one of those. And the quality factor is really high. I'll also keep a couple smaller 1-inch screws around. Not a whole lot, no bolts, no organized bolts, washers, nuts, or anything like that. I do keep the 1¼-inch Craig fine thread and coarse thread screws, and those are the size that you would use when pocket hole screwing a 3/4-inch board together. And then lastly, I do keep one, it's like a 10-inch by 10-inch hardware organizer. It's real small. It almost looks like a tackle box, and it's compartmentalized into, 12 different sections. And that's where I put any like small miscellaneous screws or bolts. So if what I need isn't one of those 5 or 6 common screws that I carry, I go to that and I look and see if I've got it. And if not, I go to the hardware store, but very rarely does that end up happening. What about you?
You'd be surprised. I do not have a very organized storage or organized system of screws. But I do agree with you. Those GRKs, especially the, see, I call them washer heads.
Yeah. That's a good name.
Okay. Okay. So I keep the cabinet screws. I keep a 1½, 2, and 3-inch cabinet screws. Sometimes I need to go into a stud or whatnot. Those are screws that I actually like will buy boxes of. And like I have a drywall screw and a couple like roofing, things for home DIY type stuff. But for the most part, I just buy what I need and I always end up with more. And so I just have this like catch-all drawer with all the cabinet screws and hardware that's been accumulated over like different machines and whatnot. But no, I don't have an organized system. So, and I don't feel like I need it either because there are just, anything that you need is just either going to be at Lowe's or Home Depot or just a click away from the computer. So to me, I just don't keep a lot of that stuff. I don't have like this huge wall. I mean, I can remember my adopted father having just this wall of mason jars with the different screws. And you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
I don't have anything like that. Nothing like that. Everything is just all in one drawer. That's it. So, Guy, how about you? You got all the mason jars?
No, but I have several drawers full of screws and fasteners. And that's just mainly because I've accumulated all that stuff over the years because you buy something for a project and you have extra and it goes there. Anyways, as far as screws, I agree a lot with what you guys said. 1¼-inch. And I prefer 1¼-inch, and the second go-to screw would be like 2-inch.
Yeah.
I also keep some 5/8 and 3/4-inch screws. Mm-hmm. Now, unless I have a specific project for them, all my screws that I buy are for countersinking. They're flat on top. I don't like the washer on the screw. That's because they stand proud. Those are for pocket holes. Mm-hmm. And even when you're building cabinets, you can't have that screw sticking out the side. Maybe for mounting stuff, it's nice to have that, but I much prefer to have the flatheads. Because like I said, you can countersink them. Mm-hmm. I keep a lot of those screws handy. I've got several different kinds. I agree on the GRK for the big screws. If you're building cabinets, just buy the cheapest you can get your hands on. Again, I prefer 2-inch screws when putting cabinets together. The GRKs are nice. I actually built a shipping crate for something for us at work, and I built the frame on the inside. It was, like a really expensive big piece that we shipped halfway across the country. So it was a really, really big crate. It was like, 9 feet long kind of crate. And I made it out of hickory because we had a lot of hickory at the time. And I was taking those GRK screws, that were 3-inch long and just drilling them right through. I mean, not even pre-drilling, just driving them right in through a 1½-inch hickory. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I keep pin nails in stock.
Brads.
Yep. 3/4-inch. and some 1-inch, that's the bulk of what I go through. When I'm putting together furniture, I don't use a lot of screws. There's not a lot of hardware because everything is joinery. If I'm building cabinets, the only screws I really want are 2-inch flathead screws because I'll just screw right through the side, right into whatever I'm screwing into. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Guy, you mentioned using 5/8 and 3/4 inch mm-hmm. screws. Do you have a brand or a supplier that you steadily go to for those? I've had a hard time finding a good, like, smaller screw like that.
I get a lot of that stuff at Rockler.
Yeah.
They have a very good supply. And I should mention, I also really prefer Robertson bits, which are the square head.
Yeah.
There's two different sizes. There's a number one size and a number two size. That's referring to the size of the square in the end. I prefer mm-hmm. the number twos.
For pocket holes or for just in general?
Just in general. Because that's why everything is the same. Sometimes I bought those 5/8 inch screws and they came with number one. And I was like, damn it. I don't have the bit for it. So,
I tried, what is that? Posi bits.
Yeah.
Okay. Posi bits. Yes. I'm sorry. PZ, I think, is the, I guess, abbreviation for it or whatever.
Yeah.
But the posi bits, I like those too. I mean, they're not as, I prefer the square or the Torx head, but posi bits are kind of nice.
Yeah,
I've used that a little bit. I just started using that for these five millimeter Euro cabinet screws.
Yeah, that's a posi bit. And the thing with the posi bit is it's got little ridges. It's like a Phillips,
yeah.
But it's got little ridges in there. So you can put the screw on the driver bit and they'll pretty much kind of stay on.
Yeah,
they don't flop around all over the place. It's kind of nice.
But
yeah, that's pretty much what I use most of the time in the shop.
Yeah. So right on.
And I have a little drawer that has little bins in it that's got, you know, the most used stuff, and it's mostly the screws.
Mm-hmm.
And if I need something, I just go in there, I pull the bin out and take it over to the bench with me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's one drawer of that, and then there's two junk drawers full of stuff. All right. So I hope that helps. And I've got the next question here. And this comes from David, Excuse for Tools Custom Woodwork. I like that. He says he really appreciates the podcast. He's been listening for about 18 months, and I'm also working through your previous episodes. His question is, I'm starting to dive into spray finishing. I have previously used wipe-on or brush-on finishes. I like shellac, but often coat with wipe-on poly for extra protection. I would picture doing the same going forward. Question, what are considerations or benefits to using a water-based conversion varnish over water-based poly? What type of PPE or personal protective equipment is appropriate? I have a relatively large shop, which is climate controlled, not attached to house, and I can set up an area for finishing when needed. What type of ventilation would be desirable for occasional finishing in this situation? He says he builds furniture and smaller items. Thanks, David, at Excuse for Tools Custom Woodwork. So I'm just a fan of the water-based conversion varnish because it's a lot like lacquer. Dries fast. It's easy to repair, while the water-based poly really is not an easy-to-repair thing. Both are water-white. In other words, it doesn't add any amber tones or anything like that to the wood, which is why I usually use a coat of shellac underneath. I prefer amber shellac because it will give it that amber tones that you get with an oil-based finish. And plus it helps seal the wood. And then I'll spray the water-based conversion varnish over that. What about PPE, Hui?
I wear it's the big pink ones, and I believe it is the
Those are particulate.
Organic big, vapor?
Those are the big pink discs?
Yeah. No, those are particulate. No. Okay. Not the discs. They're not the discs. It's a cartridge. I know what you're talking about. It's not that. It's, I believe, the organic vapor one.
Yeah, the VOCs.
Yes, yeah. And that's the one that I use. Honestly, I just keep those on there. If I'm even like in the shop, like bandsawing or sanding a whole bunch and I need a mask, I just keep those on there for now on. And I have another one. I have two masks. I have the Ellipse that I use for like if I'm just going to be sanding, right? So I do have one that's, you know, more full face. And then I wear goggles and I have gloves on. That's it. That's all I use. And I feel like that's all that is required for the water-based CV and even the water-based poly and 2K polys as well. I believe that's about all that's required in terms of PPE.
Yeah,
I've seen them like with the long sleeves and, you know, or, you know, full coverings and I don't know. I sometimes wear a t-shirt.
Yeah, I don't do all that. I put on a respirator with the VOC cartridges on it and that's about it.
Yeah. You wear glasses, so your eyes are
good. Yeah, yeah. I really don't care if I get any on my hands because it's water based. I'm not going to get that much on my hands anyways.
Yeah.
The big thing is the blowback. All that spray ends up in the air, and you've got to get a way to get it out of the shop. Otherwise, it just lands and puts this fine coat of dust all over everything, which is a pain. What about you, Brian? You don't spray at all, do you?
I don't. I don't spray, so I really don't have anything to add here, but I've been taking notes on what you guys said. It's very helpful.
Can I ask a question, actually? Yeah. I'm about to be spraying some shellac. What kind of shop coverings or things do you do to when you're spraying shellac? Is it any different?
No, I used to do this big thing where I would cover everything in the shop with plastic and go through all those gymnastics. I just don't do it anymore. I put up a piece of canvas that I attached to my garage door overhead rail to like block off half the shop. I cover a few tools with plastic, but that's about it. I just let things fall. And I open up the garage door just a crack. I put a board underneath there and I open up the man door that's in the back so I can get some cross ventilation. I put a fan there to help blow stuff through. But I'm not really that concerned about it, to be honest with you. I wear the mask and I'm good. With shellac, I probably won't cut or cover anything. I just spray the shellac right where the stuff sits. I'll put it in the center of my shop on some stands and just go ahead and spray it.
Right on. Okay. Not even a drop cloth with shellac?
No. I just spray it.
All right.
I'm not that worried about it because it's it's just alcohol based. If it gets on anything, I don't have a nice floor in my shop. It's, you know, like cracked cement. Yeah. So it's got paint all over it. It's got all kinds of stains all over it. It just doesn't matter to me if I get something on there.
Yeah.
So, but as far as he's talking about ventilation in a shop, I mean, it really doesn't take much. I have one of those overhead air filters, one of the jets. And like I said, I crack a couple doors so I can get cross ventilation. I may add a fan if I'm doing a lot of spraying. Yeah. Sometimes it's, you know, like in the wintertime, it's too darn cold to do that. So I just keep the doors closed and I let everything fall where it is and I clean it up later.
Yeah. I do run the air filter though, when I'm spraying, I'll run the air filter. And if it's too cold, typically it's too hot. And that's really bad because you can get some blushing if it's too hot, too humid. from outside. So actually, a lot of times, I won't even open the man door. I'll just crack open the garage door and keep the HVAC thing going, mini split going.
Yeah,
I'll crank that sucker up. You know, just try to keep everything same temperature in the shop. But
yeah, all right. Well, I hope that helps, David. And I guess we're going to go back to you, Hui.
Yeah, so this question is from Peter Diaz. I love to use my hand planes and can't get over the smooth glass-like feeling that it leaves on wood. However, many finishing manufacturers recommend applying the finish to a surface sanded to a specific grit. For example, Rubio Monocoat recommends applying to 120 grit, no higher. What are the advantages, disadvantages to applying finish to a sanded surface versus a hand plane surface? I would like my hand plane to be the last thing that touches the wood, but I want to respect the manufacturer's recommendations since they obviously know information I don't, like what the ideal porosity of wood is. Thanks, Peter Diaz. So that is exactly... So let's just be, and I'm not talking about all manufacturers, but if you brought up the Rubio Monocoat thing here, which was they recommend 120, and that is an absorption issue, okay? The Rubio Monocoat it's an oil. It is an oil. And so the only way it can properly absorb into the wood is if there's a little bit of porosity to it. Going any finer and you sort of burnish or essentially are sealing the wood with the fried off wood grain, and it's getting into the wood grain, and you know, you're having issues with that proper absorption. Now, to alleviate that, you can either blow out or vacuum the surface and actually expose a little bit more of the pores of the grain. So just FYI, we're not saying here that, you know, I don't know about Rubio, but we're not saying that, you know, in order for finish to properly absorb into the wood grain, you got to be at one. No, that's not what we're
saying.
You
have to remember too about Rubio Monocoat, it's not furniture finish.
It's floor
finish. It's designed for floors.
Yeah.
Don't put it on furniture. Put it on your floors.
I put it on my furniture.
That would solve the whole problem of using it for its proper intention.
Fair. But
not a fan, as you can tell.
Yes, I can tell. But I believe that the advantages, quote unquote, if you're using that specific product or some type of oil product that needs to absorb deeply into the wood, would be that, you know, sanding to 120 keeps the pores more open on the wood so that you're getting more absorption. Maybe that is probably true just from a physics point of view, but I do not finish my furniture to 120. I'm going to a higher grit, and I've never had issues with finishes, particularly shellac, adhering to hand plane surfaces. Myself, I typically sand everything before finishing. I'm not a hand plane exclusive person. Now, I have finished things that have been hand planed and not sanded, but that has been on a rare occasion. So, but I don't think that there are any real huge advantages other than maybe that one specific product to, you know, having that smoother, quote unquote, glass-like feel versus sanding. Like I said, I've never had absorption issues with finishes with hand plane surfaces. So
will, with a hand plane surface where you're severing the fibers rather than burnishing the fibers, mm-hmm. like you would when you're sanding, mm-hmm. which in theory, I guess, leaves the end of the straw more open.
Yeah.
Would a hand planed board absorb finish more deeply, or would it soak it up more than a surface that had been sanded, even, you know, to 220 or 320?
I don't know the true answer to that. I've never run the experiments, but in my experience, I've not seen an issue with finishes adhering to hand plane surfaces.
Yeah.
That's just never been my experience.
Yeah.
And I've only done a number. It's, now, mind you, it's not a lot of furniture pieces, But I mean, I know a lot of people that, you know, apply finish on top of hand plane surfaces. Yeah. I've done it a number of times, not a lot.
Yeah.
And it's never been an issue.
Yeah.
So, and I don't think it is an issue. And I don't think that's something that Peter needs to worry about.
Yeah.
You know, if that's the route that he wants to go. I don't know if Rubio is the right finish for him in this instance. I think either a shellac or some type of shellac-based finish is probably going to be better, because it sounds like what he's trying to do here is more like fine finish type things. So in that instance, I think shellac might be better.
Yeah, I get the sense that the mention of Rubio is merely as an example of a manufacturer that provides a grit recommendation for finish or sanding to prior to applying their finish.
Yeah, It may well be, but I am not familiar with anybody else that says you need to sand. You can't sand past this point. Again, that stuff is designed for floors. So I would imagine if you're, you know, sanding a floor, you don't need to go much more than 120 grit. As far as the hand plane stuff goes, I finish sand everything. Even if I've got a hand plane surface, I still may go over it with like 220 or 320 or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I've never had a problem with finish sticking on things that I've sanded to 220 or 320. It depends on what type of finish you're putting on. So if I'm putting on a finish that's like a film finish, like a water-based polyurethane or polyurethane type finish, I typically don't sand past 180 because it doesn't matter at that point.
Right. You're building up over top of it anyway.
Yep. Yeah. On shellac, if you know, like, let's say I'm working on a box, a small box that's you're going to be touching with your hands, I may finish that to, you know, finish sand that to 320 and then put a couple coats of shellac on it, and that's it, because it's not going to see like huge use, and shellac is fine and it sticks to that just fine. So,
I'm gonna hijack the question real quick. Your box example guy, where you might sand it to 320. If your box is made of a highly figured maple, does the grit that you sand to, is there a grit to sand to accentuate that figure prior to applying the shellac? Like, is the higher the grit you sand to going to highlight that figure more or not really?
I've never experienced that. So I can't say yes or no to that. I'm going to say no in my experience, but it may, I don't know. I've never had the problem. So there you go. The thing that mostly affects the popping of the grain in figured wood is what type of finish you're putting on it.
Yeah.
So I guess the question goes to Brian now.
All right. Back to me for question number two. This question is from Joshua from the Black Dog Woodworks. He says, "Hi guys, my question this time is about design. Specifically, it's about design based on that special piece of lumber. For example, I purchased a large piece of mahogany in the late 1990s to build electric guitars. I made two guitars from it and was left with a chunk of beautiful lumber that traveled with me for the next 25 years. 2 years ago, I bought a mid-sized slab of black locust. I don't make slab furniture or use copious amounts of epoxy, so I'll end up cutting it up into a project. I know you guys normally design your projects and then buy the lumber, but have you ever bought or acquired that unique board and then had to design a project to do it justice? If so, what was the project? As a follow-up question, what's the longest you've ever owned a piece of lumber that you just couldn't get rid of? Thanks, Joshua." All right. So the question is, have you ever bought or acquired that unique board and then had to design a project to do it justice? I am actually a big fan of that. And a lot of times if I am shopping for lumber and I see a board and I'm like, that board's really unique. I really like I see a piece of walnut and it's got really straight grain. Even if I don't have a project for it at the time, I'll often buy it knowing that down the road that board is going to come greatly in handy in a project. I don't know. There's something, and maybe this is just me, but sometimes starting with the project and then going after the lumber for me is almost harder than the other way around. And maybe I'm just a weirdo with that, but it seems like every time I have that project in mind and then I go look for the lumber, everything is just very bland and generic and uninspiring from a lumber standpoint.
Mm.
And alternatively, excuse me, alternatively, when I acquire the boards and either acquire enough or over time accumulate enough, then finally, I have enough and I will find a project to do for that. Now that all inspires that, or that all assumes that your projects that you're building are at your leisure and discretion and that you're not, being tasked with something, so I'm a little backwards in that regard. What do you think about that? How do you go about aligning your lumber selection and the boards you're acquiring with the projects that you have laid out in front of you?
Yeah. So as of right now, my lumber stash is not that huge. I mean, some people might call it actually huge, but I don't actually think it's quite large. I have some light woods, I have some medium woods, and I have some dark woods. That's what I have. And a lot of it has been accumulated over past projects that were leftover materials. And I just kind of, sector them out, based on color for what it is that I'm trying to do. And for the most part, when it comes to lumber selection, as of lately, that lumber selection is based off of what I've been given from some of the suppliers that I order from. And so it's really kind of based on that stack that I have there. And, I do the best that I'm able to do in terms of just selecting the proper grain for the proper pieces. But what I would suggest this person do is actually one of his questions pertain to having like a specific piece of wood and then trying to find out like how to design around that or how to create a piece around that. There is a really great video series on Fine Woodworking Magazine's website with Mike Pekovich. Yeah. And he talks about building a furniture piece from a single board and how to sort of design around that. I've not experimented a ton with that. When I've needed wood, I go and get enough for the project that I'm building, and the design sort of comes first. Not what the limitations of the lumber that I have and designing around that. I've actually never done that before. But that is a very interesting concept, design process that I've never done before. I'd love to do that eventually. And in terms of a piece of wood that I just can't seem to get rid of, when I went to Tim Fuller's shop out in Iowa to build a rocking chair, he had cut me a couple of 2-inch slabs, I guess you would call it, of this walnut crotch that is really cool. And it's all like book matched and whatnot. Eventually I would like to resaw that so that I can make some top surface or panel or whatnot. Guy, have you ever designed furniture around a piece of wood?
Yes.
Has that ever been a thing?
Yes.
And did you enjoy that?
Yes. I actually did a video on it.
Oh yeah?
Where I built a wall cabinet out of a piece of figured ash that I had.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go in the video, I don't go into a lot of process about that, but it's actually pretty simple. You got this board that's got some great figure and there's straight lines, there's some curvy stuff. So you just kind of take a look at it and determine what pieces of the wood would look good in certain parts of your project.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like door panels, there's drawer mm-hmm. fronts, things like that, that you can envision that figure of the wood calling out to you. So just take a piece of chalk and outline it. and say, I've got a piece this big. Okay. That's going to be, and in design in general, you always want to have or try to have one single focal point of the piece. So let's say you've got that piece of, you know, highly figured wood, and there's this one part that's got a lot of figure in it, really, you know, it's really going to pop. Outline that and design the rest of the project around it. I know it sounds stupid, but it's actually fairly easy. Once you figure that out and what you can make with that size piece of wood, the rest comes into play. Most of the time when I've got wood like that, I just put it into boxes because it's easy. Most of the time I'm just buying wood for the project.
Yeah.
But if I find you order 100 board feet of lumber or 200 board feet of lumber comes in, you order, let's say, you know, maple, and it comes in, and then you get this one or two boards that half of them are curly.
Yeah.
Those don't go into the project.
Yeah.
Those get set aside. Mm-hmm. And then 25 or 30 years later, you run across them again. I have boards like that. I have this piece of cherry that I've been carrying around with me for probably 30 years now. Every now and then I come across and go, oh yeah, I remember that board. Yeah. It's this piece. It's maybe like 16, 18 inches wide, about 2 feet long. And it's this quilted cherry that's just unbelievable. And I've never done anything with it. I made a shaker nightstand or a shaker sofa table out of it for a customer and sold it many years ago in the early 2000s, maybe 2001. Anyways, and I've had that piece of that board since. So it's like 20 some years old. I shouldn't say 30, 20 some years old.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all wood hoard stuff.
Yep. I don't know. I try not to. I keep my stack pretty slim. I mean, it's not slim, but it's not like overflowing. Like I don't have like things just all over the shop.
My lumber storage is, I wouldn't say full right now, but it's got a lot of lumber in it. I may have maybe 300 board feet of lumber over there right now. It doesn't matter if it's 100 board feet or 300 board feet. It's still taking up the same amount of room.
Yeah.
So until it starts overflowing, I don't worry about it.
Right.
So, make sense?
Yep. Hope that helps, Joshua.
All right. So our next question comes from Jason. And Jason says, I really enjoy the podcast. Your answers are efficient, helpful, and easily digestible to a beginning woodworker. Well, thank you, Jason. So, he says, I recently acquired a Jessam Pocket Mill Pro for loose tenon joints. Like many, I had lusted after a Festool Domino, but couldn't justify the price tag for a hobby shop. The Pocket Mill Pro is a fraction of the cost and does everything I need it to do for my projects. The workstation that pairs the Pocket Mill Pro can also accept Jessam's dowel jig. My question to you all is, would a dowel jig even be necessary when I have the ability to make loose tenon joints already? Is there any advantage to adding a dowel jig to my arsenal, or is it a waste of money when I already have the Pocket Mill Pro? Thanks for advance for any insight. So this is a question that's been floating around for a long time. Do I need a Festool Domino? The answer is no, you don't need one. Do you maybe want one? Sure. Loose tenon joinery can be done with a lot of different tools. The advantage of the Domino, it's a point and shoot thing. And I tell you what, working where I do now, we could not operate without a Festool Domino. Everything is dominoed together. I don't think we've ever made a mortise and tenon joint there. Everything is dominoed together. Everything. So it's a really good joint. As far as where a doweling jig fits into all this, I'm a big fan of dowels. there was a time many, many years ago, but there wasn't even biscuit joiners. There was dowels, and then there was dowels. So you can make a doweling jig pretty easy. You can buy them fairly inexpensively. The dowel jig I have is easily 35 or 40 years old, and it was just a cheap, you know, $30 one that you just clamp on the side of the boards. It's your standard doweling jig. And it works fine. I haven't used it in a while, but it's nice to have it when you need it. And the advantages of dowels are it's an easy thing to do because you just drill a hole. Doesn't require a lot of setup. You just put it on there and boom, you're off to the races. And it can go in a fairly tight space too. Right. Sometimes dominoes are too big for a, you know, using the rule of thirds, which is you don't want to go over, you know, more than two thirds in some situations, but a third is mostly where you want to be. Anyways, so I like having a doweling jig. I think it's a good idea. I'm not familiar with the Jessam doweling jig, but I remember looking at it once and saying, wow, that's really expensive.
I think it's $250 for the...
For
the mill itself.
Well, not the Pocket Mill Pro, but I'm saying the Jessam doweling jig.
Oh, I think it's like $120 or $150, something like that.
Yeah.
Jessam doweling jig.
Is that pre-pandemic or post-pandemic? Because it could be, you know, $600 now. I have no idea. I haven't looked at them in years.
But, no, it did go up in price. It's $240.
That's a lot of money for a doweling jig.
Yeah, that
it really is. What's the name of that other doweling, the Dowelmax?
That one's expensive too.
Yeah, that's really expensive, but it's very nice.
It's a very nice, well-milled, well-machined.
Yeah, it's a big
tool,
big block of aluminum with a lot of features.
I don't have either of those. I have a very cheapo Amazon self-centering. Actually, no, I think it came from Woodcraft. Maybe it came from Rockler?
Doesn't matter.
It's a very inexpensive doweling jig.
It's the old school doweling jig.
Right, self-centering, right, yeah. You know. Yeah. And, I mean, if you're already... So the Pocket Mill Pro is obviously making these loose tenons, and it's elongating this, like, bit that you're using on a drill, right? Very cool tool, and wonderful that that's within your price range to be able to do loose tenons. There are three things. One, a dowel jig can get into like those places that you said, tighter places. It's fairly inexpensive too. And the third, it doesn't take that much space or room in your shop to have. So in that situation, I don't see why every person that's doing woodworking shouldn't at least have a doweling jig in their toolbox. It's a very inexpensive thing to have. And when you're in a situation where you have to, you know, locate something or lock something in, man, it's just really handy to have it.
Yeah.
I haven't used it a lot in a while, but it's really handy to have.
It's better to have one and not need it than need it and not have it.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Brian? Have you used dowels before?
You know, I have actually never used dowels.
Sacrilege.
I jumped right to the domino. Does the Pocket Mill Pro, I mean, it is a doweling jig as I understand it, right?
Yes.
So yes. Is there any additive benefit? Well, does it render the regular Jessam doweling jig, does it render that obsolete if you have the Pocket Mill Pro?
No. Nothing is going to obsolete a doweling.
I mean, I guess is it redundant? I guess is maybe what I'm asking.
I think it might be more expensive than necessary. I don't think it's redundant. There's a lot of things in our shops that are redundant.
I don't know if the Pocket Mill Pro is a doweling jig.
It's not a doweling jig.
No,
it's a loose tenon. It's for make loose tenons.
Right.
Got it. So it's creating an elongated.
Yeah.
Right.
Got it.
Right.
Kind of like a domino joint.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he's asking, you know, do I still, if I've got this, do I still need a a Dowling jig.
I was late to the game with that.
Yeah. For certain tasks, I think it does. Here's a perfect example, right? And I made my own dowel jig in this situation, but I had to install ball catches on my cabinet, China cabinet that I'm building. Mm-hmm. Well, I just made a dowel jig to locate on the rail of the door and the frame of the cabinet. I'm not going to use a domino. I'm not going to use some fancy tool for that. I'm just using a dowel jig. That's all I'm. Yeah. That's all I'm doing.
If I know Hui is somewhat, I'm not sure about Brian, but you know, there's a gentleman that designed and built a lot of furniture over the years named James Krenov. Hmm. Krenov used a lot of dowels. He doweled everything together.
And it works.
Yeah, and that's you know, if you own a Krenov piece, you're a lucky person. But anyways, yeah, dowels are a great way to join furniture. There's a lot of people that's all they use are dowels. So right, I think it's a good tool to have in your arsenal. I don't know if the Jessam is the answer or the cheap one is the answer. That's just going to depend on your situation. Myself, I just have the cheaper one. And it works fine.
Yeah. 250.
That's a lot.
And then another 240 for the dowel jig. I don't know.
You're halfway to a domino at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I probably would go with the less expensive dowel jig and just have that in my arsenal and probably do everything I need.
Yeah. But. All right. So I guess that ends the question portion, Michelle. Now, what do you got going on in the shop right now, Brian?
Just wrapping up installation of the big built-in I've been working on. So thankful for that and can turn my attention to some home projects. We're redoing our fireplace area to put up some shiplap, and I'm going to be making a white oak miter folded fireplace beam mantle looking thing. So I've got a bunch of quarter sawn white oak in the garage for that. So that'll be the next, I guess, woodworking that I do. What about you, Wee?
Oh, man. I just finished sanding and applying dye stain to this china cabinet. And now I'm in the process of mixing and getting everything ready to start spraying the interior before I do assembly. And I actually contacted our friend Sean and asked him about his pound cuttage that he uses to spray shellac. And I also asked Guy about the pound cuttage that I should use to spray shellac. And so I think I got it figured out. I think I'm going to go with a pound and a half cut and pre-finish the insides, tape everything off, assemble, and then finish the outside. How about you, Guy? What you got going on?
Nothing. Nothing. I have a.
Are you done with those cabinets?
Oh yeah, they're hanging in the room. I've got a lot of home stuff that I have to do. So I don't know if I need to talk about it, but there's just a lot of stuff I need to do around the house, and it mostly has to do with trim and a few very small projects, but nothing major. But it's a lot. I got to do a lot of trim. Mm-hmm. So. Right. That's about it. I have to figure out how to get pocket doors apart. I've never pulled one apart. I've got two of them that I need to pull out and paint. So,
fun.
I guess there's a YouTube video for that. So, I think that's going to do it for the show. And we would like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and feedback. And please remember, this podcast is here to answer questions from you, the woodworking community. So if you have working questions you would like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com or DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. And I can be found on YouTube at Guy Shop and most other social media platforms as Guy's Woodshop. What about you, Hui?
AlabamaWoodworker.com. Just search there and you can find out what I'm doing, which isn't a lot, but you can at least reach out if you need me. And Brian, how about you?
Not on any of your traditional social medias. I do have an account on simplecove.com at Brian Schmidt.
Awesome. All right.
Very good. And I guess we'll talk to you guys in a couple weeks.
Sounds good.
Talk to you in a couple.
See you.
See you.